General Hackett, Tree 1. You've already made a tape recording for us about your experiences with the Transjordan Frontier Force. I wonder if you could tell me now about your Second World War experience after you left them, please.
Do you want a complete blur-by-blur narrative? Otherwise, if you did, then it takes a very long time. But I prepared nothing, but you'd probably like me to look at what I remember and choose from it what seems to me of more salient importance.
Please.
Off you there. Well, when the World War broke out, peace broke out in Palestine, the hostilities between Arab and Jew ceased overnight, virtually speaking. In Palestine, the Jews were busy storing up resource for a resumption of the so-called struggle when the war should end. And very prudently, they used their time and resource in the formation and service of units serving under the Allies and arms or in ancillary occupations during the war. And Arabs, to some extent, did the same. I mean, there was a spate of recruiting for the Arab Legion in Jordan, for example. In the TJFF, we had a certain spin-off, but operations in Palestine then, in rising out of Jewish-Arab hostility, virtually came to an end. I was then still in the Transjordan Frontier Force, serving out the end of my four-year secondment contract, which had taken me from the 8th King's Royal Irish Hussars, then part of the Cairo Cavalry Brigade, into a contract with the Palestine government, really, for a four-year service. And I was serving in Palestine then. And quite early on was made a staff officer in the Jordan Valley to help the headquarters of the Transjordan 24th handle problems which hadn't arisen before but did arise now that the world was at war. I won't enlarge upon those, but I went from there to the staff college in Haifa and did the war course, and then came back to be a G2 in the headquarters of the Transjordan Frontier Force. And it was as that I went up into Syria with the on the invasion, the British and, as it turned out, Free French invasion of Syria, to counter the German infiltration, which the collapse of France had permitted, and which meant that airfields and other staging posts in Syria and the Lebanon, now under Vichy French control, were being made available to the Reich to be used as stepping stones into their in furtherance of their penetration of the further east, that is to say, into India. And under General Wilson, an Australian and British force, which incorporated the Transjordan 24th, was put together and invaded Syria, and I went up with the headquarters of the Transjordan 24th to do what was necessary in our share of the action. And in the course of this, I was concerned in an operation on the Damascus Road at a village called Ezra, E-Z-R-A-A, if you like to spell it that way, which contained a garrison of Vichy-controlled troops in a little Beaugest-type fort, which the rather motley crowd that was assembled under, really there, under the TGFF, because that happened to be the handiest element of command. And we had to attack this place, which we did. And I had then, as part of a squadron of TGFF, a section of 20 pounders, elements of a Sikh battalion, including a couple of carriers manned by Sikhs, some anti-tank weapons, and a company of the Royal Fusiliers. And we put this together into a force which virtually I commanded, and we attacked this place. And using the anti-tank guns to keep down machine gun fire from this little fortress, it was possible eventually to get in and receive the surrender of some 220 tirailleurs Tunisiens, the French, the Vichy French had assembled there. And I, of course, had a the best, also, I hadn't mentioned, the best part of a battalion of native troops from Lake Chad under Free French officers. Well, when this little fight was over, every officer on my side had been either killed or wounded, and I'd been injured by a hand grenade, but we received their surrender. And that was the end of that, as far as I was concerned, and the occupation of Syria and Lebanon went on, and I went off to hospital. Released from there in Jerusalem a little later, unfit as yet to go back to my regiment in the desert, which I wanted to do, the 8th Hussars, I was posted to be Secretary of the Commission of Control, Syria and the Lebanon, and went up there to do what had to be done in the administration of these occupied territories. And while I was walking down the streets, I got to tell you this, I may have done it before, I don't know, but it amuses me to reflect on it. While I was walking down the streets of Beirut with my right arm in a sling, I saw coming towards me in the crowd a blue kepi covering a familiar face, turned out to be a chap I'd known in the Groupement Druze of French cavalrymen, seconded like me in the TGFF to the Groupement Druze. And he had his left arm in a sling. And I'd played polo with them before, gone racing in Damascus with them before, and I knew this chap quite well. Hello, Jacques, where'd you get that? Oh, a little place on the Damascus Road. Where'd you get yours? Oh, a little place on the Damascus Road. Well, when I got in there, into this little fortress, I did notice some dead horses lying around, which suggested to me that an element of the Groupement Druze had been there and had evacuated shortly before he arrived. And it was equally clear to me now that this chap, my old friend Jacques, had commanded that lot before we took a hand in it. And he said, well, it must have been the same bit of bother. We'd better go and talk about it. So we went and lunched at the Saint-Georges, which was in splendid order then. I remember so well, I wouldn't bother with what we hadn't drank, because it was magnificent in those days. And he ran through this battle at Ezra. He said, so you were in charge on the other side. Well. Now, just let's go into this. Now, why did you do so-and-so? And I think I probably said, well, I couldn't think of anything else, really. And then why did you do this? That seems to be a defiance of all normal tactical rules. World is the best I could think of at the time. And then, around here, what were you doing? Foch would have turned in his grave if he'd seen that. Well, I said, anyway, it all worked out. Though my opinion of my own military capability on the battlefield was growing less and less. I could only say in the end, well, Jacques, in the end we did win. We did win. Yes, he said, in typical French fashion, Yes, and that is the least satisfactory aspect of the whole squalid episode. So I did that, and I left the Commission of Control, got married in Jerusalem, and went back to my regiment in the Western Desert to serve in tanks, which I didn't know much about.
What did you notice in the Syrian campaign about the attitude of the Vichy French to the Free French?
Very hostile. Indeed, in my view, it was a great mistake, and one upon which we counted upon the higher command to avoid, to introduce the Free French at all, because there was very highly professional content of the troupe française du Levant under General Weygand before that, up to the fall of France, and they were servants of the French government, and very properly they were going to resist invasion from whatever quarter, even if it came from their very recent allies against the Germans. And we were the invaders, but we hoped that they would put up a token resistance to satisfy their professional requirements, and before long recognized that there was no future in it and they'd give up. And we relied upon an undertaking we understood was given by General Jumbo Wilson in Egypt, that Free French troops would not be introduced, and we very much hoped this would be carried out, because those of us who knew the form with the French and the British and so on, we were pretty confident that the introduction of the Free French would turn what might have been a face-saving campaign on behalf of the troupes françaises du Levant into a civil war, a small-scale civil war, particularly as there were units of the Foreign Legion in Syria and the Lebanon, and units of the Foreign Legion had been organized in the Free French. And this didn't bode any too well for a friendly, face-saving gesture. And in fact, that fighting turned out to be quite severe. I remember how one's heart sank as I saw in the very early morning. I was inside Lebanese territory, up telegraph posts, snipping wires to interfere with the lateral communications of the enemy, and saw coming up the road a line of lorries, dusty, untidy, containing a ragtag and bobtail of a soldiery whom I recognized as Free French up out of the canal zone. I thought, oh, Jesus, what's this going to lead to? And of course it did, and we had no end of a battle on our hands. It was, considering the scale of the operations, and quite heavy casualties. So that my answer to the question you asked is that the inevitable hostility between troops who had, as they put it, rallied to De Gaulle, and troops who remained loyal to what was in fact the constitutional government of France, the Vichy government, the animosity that was bound to develop between these two could only lead to much heavier fighting than would otherwise have been the case. And so old hands, those who had been serving those parts for quite a long time, were very much against it and deplored Jumbo Wilson's disregard of what we understood to have been an earlier firm undertaking that this would not happen. Now, while we were trying to settle the country in the occupation period, after the ceasefire and the truce, while terms of surrender were under negotiation, which I was having a considerable part to play, the Free French asked to be allowed to conduct a recruiting campaign for De Gaulle. And I must say, I was not in favour of this, because we were trying to do an umpire's job, and it wasn't really for us to take a hand in what was really an internal French dispute about the nature of their government. And so I thought it would be best not to allow a recruiting campaign by the Free French. But in effect, we did allow them to move around the Vichy French camps, and they did rope in more or less surreptitiously, a number of converts who were rallied into the units being raised and commanded by de Gaulle. Well, that was a fairly untidy time, really. But we got those Vichy French who wanted to be repatriated to France under flag of truce back to Marseille in French shipping under a guarantee of immunity. And that cleared that lot out and left the field more or less free to General Catrou and the Free French element, with the Spears mission, Louis Spears, playing a very prominent part in trying to handle the interface, as you might call it. But having written up the report on the operations of the Control Commission up to the time that it was closed down, and handed that over for publication, it's lurking somewhere around a blue paper-clad official communication, which is my account of the deliberations of the Commission of Control, a thing which we used to drive around in motor cars in Syria and the Lebanon with a little flag on them, which somebody had rather foolishly inscribed with the capital initial C, which is immediately read by the French as the Congrès des cons. So that's what we were called. But we did sort out an administration which then entered into a more or less peaceful life under British security. And I went off to the desert, rejoined my own regiment, and was then in the 7th Armored Division, in the 4th Armored Brigade, a desert rat from the beginning, really. And on the 27th of May, was commanding a squadron, 27th of May 1942, commanding the light tech squadron of the 8th King's Royal Irish Hussars in the 4th Armored Brigade, in a regiment consisting of two Grant squadrons and one Honey squadron, two heavy and one light squadron. So I was out in front. And it was known then that Rommel was mounting what looked like a flanking operation around Bir Hakeim. And we were prepared for this, and in fact we had done a live shoot in the 4th Armored Brigade just then in a position which is known as Position Blenheim. We were going to advance to Blenheim when the armoured car patrols of our own reported that Rommel, that the one or more of his two armoured divisions was moving around Bir Hakeim to come up from the southwest towards Tobruk. Well, we were stood to that night on the 26th, 27th May and told that armoured car reports, and out there in front were the KDGs and the 12th Lancers, very, very good armoured car regiment, and a regiment as good as any of them, and that was the 4th South African armoured cars. And they were reporting that what was moving around there was moving rather faster than anybody had thought, and would be on us before long. And about midnight, I was communicated with over the blower by Colonel Gerald Kilkelly, Smash Kilkelly, who came up and said to me, "You'll be moving out in front, as you know, towards Blenheim, and it does really appear that the enemy has moved on much faster than expected. In fact, he's already round Bir Hakeim, and he's coming up our way. So take your squadron out now and report first sight." So I got a C squadron of the 8th Hussars on the move very quickly, a very handy lot, and out we went up, I remember, a slope in this typical undulating desert country. And as I reached the top of this rise, the commanding officer was saying to me over the radio, "Report when you first see them." And I came over the top, and there in front of me was the whole bloody German army, as far as I could see, coming my way. So the only answer I could give to the colonel's transmission report when you first sighted him was, I'm engaging now. And because I put up a black flag to say attack, wireless was not too reliable and used to break down very soon after an action was engaged. In those days, you had to rely upon flags to retain any sort of control. And I put up a black flag saying attack, and like a mug, forgot to take it down again. And any tank flying a flag is, of course, a control element and attracts fire. And so I attracted all the fire there was. And I suppose my tank was the first in 8th Army that day to be knocked out, which was in about 3 minutes of putting up the black flag. And I got quite badly burnt, but stayed on sticking around for a few days when the remnants of the 8th Hussars, and we lost practically all of our 2 squadrons of Grants who'd been overrun illegally, hadn't been able to move out. And C squadron was pretty well all that remained, and we were incorporated into the 3rd Royal Tank Regiment, then commanded by that great fighting officer, Pip Roberts, as commanding officer of the 3rd Royal Tanks, and we formed a 2nd squadron, no, 4th squadron of his. Until what had been happening to me came too much, and they wheeled me away in an ambulance on a most uncomfortable journey into a naval hospital in Alexandria. From there, I managed to get myself discharged in due course, get back to my squadron in the desert. And then for the rest of that summer, 1942, we were a squadron at large. We had no regimental headquarters, no commanding officer, he'd been captured, no quartermaster, no adjutant, no stores, nothing really but 15 tanks, a lot of good-hearted men and a bit of B-Echelon. And anybody who wanted some tanks in the column warfare that was being waged just then could count on us. And so we had a very interesting time moving up and down the desert with quite a lot of small fighting, while my own regiment was being reconstituted in Cairo, in the Middle East, in Alexandria mostly, with the return from the staff college in India of Colonel Goulburn, who had been instructing there and so had been left out of the earlier fight. He came back and took command, and the regiment had then been put together. But we fought the Battle of Alam al-Halfa as part of what had been put together a little earlier, and that was a composite regiment, the 4th 8th Hussars, because the 4th Hussars had lost everything but a squadron and a half or so, and a regimental headquarters in Greece, and we had lost everything but a squadron. And these old allies out of the Light Brigade at Balaclava, where the 4th and the 8th Light Dragoons had figured, were joined up again in the 4th 8th Hussars, and we fought the Battle of Alam al-Halfa as the 4th 8th Hussars at the bottom end of the line. Now, a lot of this is easily found in the reference books, and there's no need for me to run over it. But we did prevail in that Battle of Alam al-Halfa, and I remember so much it so well, but even more what happened afterwards, immediately afterwards, when we had had the task of closing the minefields after the armoured cars got in at the southern end of that line, which extended from the Sand Sea in the south to the Mediterranean in the north, and 7th Armoured Division was at the extreme south end of it. And the armoured cars were going to withdraw through the minefields in front of us, and we had to mine the lanes through the fields when these armoured cars got in. They were very slow coming. I mean, they stayed out a long time. It was very good. But it did mean that when they came to us, there was we were already under fire from the German Mark IVs and Mark IIIs. And putting mines in was an unaccustomed task for tank crews, but not at all comfortable to carry out in those circumstances. Well, next day the battle was over. The Germans had withdrawn, and the battle line stabilized where we were fighting, up from the Sand Sea to about Alamein. And on that morning, there was peace, no noise, the larks were singing, beautiful day. A sapper officer came out. She said, I understand you were the officer who put the mines into after the armed cars yesterday. Yes, I was, said I. Would you mind letting me have the map of your minefield? I said, don't be silly. Anybody being shot at by Marks 4 and 3 and sections like that was not really in a position to to draw up a map of where he'd put his bloody mines. Oh, he said very sarcastically, he was a very highly educated sapper officer with very thick spectacles, I remember, and he was in a jeep, which happily, I say, as events proved, had a lot of sandbags on the bottom of it. Well, he said to me rather sarcastic-like, well, at least you might tell me how many you put in. Oh, I said, a dozen. So this earnest fellow went off and removed 12 mines, started to drive through the lane he'd cleared and blew up on the 13th. Silly ass. But happily, those sandbags on the bottom of his jeep prevented any worse damage than some very bad temper. And the other thing I remember so well then was that we were enjoying this lovely weather and not being shot at. Where our chief difficulty was trying to get rid of the flies, which were trying to give us jaundice all around, and succeeding quite well. And there came up out of the blue a staff car in a cloud of dust with an ADC sitting in the front and a blackboard. And sitting in the back was a chap in a red hat. And he got out. The ADC set up the blackboard. And out there stepped a tall chap dressed as a lieutenant general in service dress, Sam Brown, boots, red hat, with, I remember, long prehensile fingers. So he gathered round everybody that was there and explained to them how he and the corps that he was commanding had won the Battle of Alma-Halfa. And as we knew perfectly well that the 7th Armored Division had won it, in which the major part had been played by the 4th Armored Brigade, and that we, the 4th 8th Hussars and the 4th Armored Brigade, had done most of that, after all. And here was the general telling us how he'd won this battle. We'd never seen him before, never heard of him. So, with warm expressions of approval and regard all round, he got back into his car with his staff officer and the blackboard and drove off into the dust. And we said to each other, now, who the bloody hell was that? And then days later, we discovered he was called Horrocks. And he'd been put in command of a corps which we, purely by accident, happened to belong to while he was fighting his battle. So, anyway, we were then preparing for Alamein, and at that time, raiding forces were proliferating in the Middle East, and the place was alive with private armies, and they were getting in each other's way, and they were often being more of a nuisance than not. And just about then, and this was August, September, in August it would have been, 42, the Tobruk raid, carried out by